Now, I want you to stay standing if you are a product of House Bill 1017. And this is how you know if you're a product. If you were in elementary school between the years of 1993 and 2008, which means you were born between 1983 and 1997, only you remain standing. If you're in Oklahoma Public Schools and you were born between the years of 1983 and 1997. Ah, thank you, House Bill 1017, because you all had small classes in elementary school, teachers who were re-energized, and that may be one of the reasons that you are some of our top students in the state who chose to be here today. You may be seated. My name is Ann Clore Duncan, and I have the honor of serving on the Oklahoma Policy Institute Board. I am a community volunteer in I live in Edmond, Oklahoma, but my passion in life is education. I care nothing more in this world than educating our future. And the people up here I have great admiration and respect for because they have either chosen that as their profession or they're fighting every day for that cause. So thank you all for being here. The way that our panel is going to work today is I will introduce each panelist one at a time, and they will give about 5 minutes remarks on what they see as the key issues facing education in Oklahoma. So they could probably talk for 5 hours, but they're going to try to talk for 5 minutes. David Blatt, who is sitting right in front of them, is their timekeeper. He'll give them a 2-minute warning, and you're finished, wrap it up. And if they're still talking, because it's going to be hard to stop, then he'll ring the bell. Aha. Thank you, David. Those are wonderful visual aids. So our first speaker today is Dr. Kurt Adams. He's an associate professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He is co-director of the Oklahoma Center for Education Policy. He studies the social psychology of schools and school systems. And you probably recognize Dr. Adams from his talks around the state this past year or in the press regarding the independent research conducted by OU-OSU on the A through F report card. Dr. Adams.
Is this on? Okay.
Yeah, I think you may have to turn them each on.
Great. First, let me thank David and the Oklahoma Policy Institute for inviting me to be a panelist today, and certainly the other panelists. I'm certainly looking forward to the opportunity to share ideas and thoughts regarding policy in this state, and of course policy at a federal and national level as well. I'm glad to see so many of you interested in policy, whether it's educational, social, healthcare as well too. I happen to think that there's a great intersection. You'll appreciate the fact I am a professor, so I tend to talk a lot, but I've written down my thoughts today to keep it succinct and hopefully within the 5-minute time frame. So I am going to read some thoughts regarding probably what I see as one of the most significant impediments to truly transforming our educational system, locally and nationally as well. And this has to do with what I call the knowledge gap. And I want to spend some time defining the knowledge gap as well as situating it in a context, an improvement context that evolves out of quality improvement in manufacturing and quality improvement in healthcare. So a few thoughts I want to share with you today. In his book, The Best Practice, Charles Kenny tells a story about quality improvement in healthcare that to me epitomizes the knowledge gap that constrains education today. Kenny describes how the medical director of Allegheny Hospital, his name was Rick Shannon, he was called before a regional task force on quality that at the time was led by the CEO of Alcoa, Paul O'Neill. And the purpose, at least as Shannon saw it going into this, was to defend the hospital's poor cardiothoracic surgery outcomes. He presented a very compelling and articulate argument as to why the indicators and the measures were inadequate and misrepresented actual performance. At the conclusion of his explanation, Dr. Shannon was told by the chair that he actually missed the point of the task force in the meeting. And the intent was not to justify the outcomes, but Paul O'Neill asserted the intent was for you to tell us what you have learned from this and how we can share in the learning so we don't ever have poor results again. So for me, this story kind of resonates as an educator. I see the story playing out on a yearly basis in states and communities across the country as accountability indicators are released to the public. School leaders, policymakers, myself, we go before the media to either claim that marginal gains in accountability scores mean reforms are working, or to promise improvement if scores dropped or stagnated. In both circumstances, comments always seem to end with proclamations about being on the path of continuous improvement. In reality, we find ourselves in a similar position as Dr. Shannon. We lack deep knowledge on the reasons for or plausible causes of variation in achievement outcomes. Not understanding how schools affect the social and human mechanisms behind great teaching and meaningful learning is the root of the knowledge gap. In the last two decades, this root has grown larger and more disruptive as school leaders have approached improvement as a simple algorithm. Adopt X intervention that is research-based, implement it with fidelity, and Y improvement will occur. This belief has led many well-intentioned individuals in search of the elusive best practice or policy. It turns out there is no single intervention or practice that has worked to produce scalable improvement. The notion of what works is merely a marketing myth exploited by an improvement industry that prospers from selling products and services. Instead of asking what works, school leaders and policymakers need to understand why, how, and for whom interventions work or do not work. A deeper understanding of effective instructional programs and meaningful learning opportunities requires knowledge on the social and human enterprise of schools. Resources that move a school or school system along the improvement journey are not ones we typically hear about in the media. Class size reduction, accountability, technology, evaluation models, smaller school size, and professional development do not create better schools. That might seem kind of astonishing for me to say that. Great schools and school systems are built on social structures that unleash the inherent motivation, the passion, the talent, and energy of school members. Teachers learn and grow from personal and shared reflections of teaching practice. Principals leverage trust and commitment to bring transformative visions to life. Students are motivated and engaged when they relate to instructional materials and find meaning in academic tasks. Learning opportunities expand when schools, families, and communities establish relational cohesion. The evidence is actually striking. Healthy cooperative relationships are the most effective and efficient resources to develop the innate talents and abilities of teachers and students. The problem is that social structures and conditions happen to be the least understood improvement mechanisms. For one, these resources are intangible and largely remain hidden to the outside. In a way, they are analogous to an individual's personality. You can't see these resources, you can't touch them, but they have a profound effect on behavior and performance. Second, fixing the educational system reminds me of Ponce de Leon's search for the fountain of youth. The myth that we can find what works for every context and every student has overshadowed the overwhelming evidence on the positive social and psychological traits found in accomplished individuals, organizations, schools, school systems. Knowledge of traits and social conditions that ignite deep engagement and instructional improvement in student learning is missing from much of the school reform improvement conversation. The reality is that no new intervention or innovation will breathe life into a stagnant educational system without social structures that make schools engaging and motivating places to teach and learn. Yet knowledge on the social and psychological health of school organizations remains deficient. By knowledge gap, I do not mean the longstanding achievement gap that rightly gets so much attention. You will not find headlines and media reports or products for the knowledge gap. It largely remains hidden behind accountability, choice, and evaluation. Federal and state policies do not target it. School systems are largely unaware of its existence, and it's not a problem that can be fixed with external interventions. Quite simply, the knowledge gap is arguably the single biggest barrier to transforming learning opportunities in schools, and it remains obscured by an improvement culture addicted to expensive interventions and products that produce unreliable results. So my thesis is simple. A modern educational system that reliably delivers quality learning experiences for all children depends on closing the knowledge gap.
Good morning, I'm sure.
I'm going to introduce you first. They have to know all of these fabulous things about you, Dr. Marshall. I'm sorry to stop you. Thank you, Dr. Adams, also. Dr. Anthony Marshall is in his 10th year as a history teacher at Booker T. Washington High School. He is responsible for the development of the Hornet Ambassador Program and the Men of Power Male Achievement Program. Dr. Marshall also developed the Summer Reading Program for incoming freshmen, in which more than 200 students participate. He encourages students to continue their education by helping them with potential scholarship opportunities and conducting an annual college tour. With an education in law, Dr. Marshall sponsors the Pipeline Project, which introduces Tulsa Public Schools students to law and the requirements for entry to law school. He was recently appointed to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation Teacher Advisory Council. Dr. Marshall.
Thank you. I appreciate that, and I'm going to keep it very simple. I'm sure I probably will not go over my 5 minutes, but I think it's important that you know some of my background to understand my position. I was born and raised right here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I am a product of Tulsa Public Schools. I went to Tulsa Public Schools while they were under a court order to desegregate. They were not desegregating, so I went to segregated schools up until I was the first class to become a part of the magnet school program. I went on to college at D. Howard University. I practiced law. And then this is a second career for me, and I think it's important that you understand that because I think I bring a different perspective to the issues that are confronting education, particularly education in the state of Oklahoma. I was not a product of education where we had Common Core and what's these other fancy things that they come up with now, No Child Left Behind. I'm a product of teachers who just taught. And that's the way I teach. Interestingly enough, when I was selected to be a part of the Teacher Leadership Effectiveness Evaluation Model, they came in and said, well, Dr. Marshall, you do a fantastic job at Standard 9 and 13, 11. I actually asked, what are those standards? I was just doing what I knew how to do based on what I had done, what I learned from my previous teachers. I am alternatively certified. I did not go through a teacher education program. So what does that mean for me in terms of education reform in the state of Oklahoma? First of all, I say our biggest problem is that education in Oklahoma lacks clear direction. I'll be very frank and honest with you. I recently received an email from the Director of Social Studies Education from the Oklahoma State Department of Education, in which he was advising us, because Common Core had been repealed, we were to use standards that we had used in the past. And I'm just going to quote you a little bit of the standards I was then told to use. Put my readers on here for that. Now, this is after I got the email saying that Common Core had been repealed in the state of Oklahoma, and go back to our standards beforehand. And it reads, in part, the Common Core history, social studies, reading, and writing literacy skills are to be integrated throughout all of the content standards and used for instructional delivery of the content. Common Core standards, well, wait a minute. Didn't you just talk about the repeal of Common Core for math and English, but we're going to use them in social studies? What's the deal here? Honestly, as a teacher, that's one of my biggest obstacles, trying to determine what it is the state of Oklahoma expects me to follow. So what will I do? I'll do what I do best, educate. The other problem that I see, and it has remained the white elephant in the room, there is a significant achievement gap, not only here in Tulsa Public Schools, but throughout the state of Oklahoma. And until we realize it and take effective means to correct it, education in Oklahoma will continue to be substandard. Yes, I teach at what is considered one of the greatest schools in the state of Oklahoma, but I have done my own data research, and I have found that right there at the Booker T. Washington High School, there is a significant achievement gap between African-American students and their white counterparts. No one wants to talk about it because we're the best in the city and one of the best in the state. I deal with it every day. Until we deal with what are our real problems in the state of Oklahoma, we will always need education reform. And then finally, when we start talking about money for teachers. Well, if any of you desire to be a teacher, let me just say this. Teachers don't make money in the first place. You know that. Focusing on the rate of pay, sure, but you've got to understand one thing. Until we can have leaders who effectively instill in their teachers that it's not about the money, that you've got to have the students at heart, Oklahoma will continue to lag behind. One thing I have asked my representative to propose to the state of Oklahoma is an incentive program. Now, we give tax breaks to all sorts of businesses to get them to open up factories here in the state of Oklahoma for manufacturing and technology. We give all sorts of incentives and tax breaks. However, we don't have an educated workforce to fill the jobs that they are now going to be creating. Why not allow undergraduate students who agree to teach in the state of Oklahoma for 5 years to have their education paid for? Is that not a tax incentive? I'm just saying. If we truly want to reform education in Oklahoma, we're going to have to look at three major problems that we have, address them clearly, frankly, and in words of one of my colleagues, don't be afraid to take prisoners. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Marshall. Lee Denny is a state representative from District 33, representing parts of Logan and Payne counties. She has been in office 10 years and serves as Assistant Majority Floor Leader. She serves on the Appropriations and Budget Committee, Higher Ed and Career Tech Committee, Energy Committee, Common Ed Committee, and is Chair of the Common Education Appropriations and Budget Committee in the House. You will often see Representative Denny in the Speaker's chair, where she brilliantly manages the House floor. This spring, Representative Denny authored several large education bills, which she might be referring to some today. And outside of the legislature, Representative Denny is a veterinarian. Representative Denny.
Thank you so much. So I come to this as a veterinarian, not as an educator. But as you guys have studied policy, you know in America we have a citizen legislature, so you find many different careers. What we do have more than anything in the House is retired teachers. We have quite a few of them. Everybody thinks all we are is a bunch of retired lawyers, but we have a few, but that's not the overwhelming majority. We have two veterinarians in the House, and we have two physicians, a pharmacist. We had a dentist. He is termed out. We have real estate agents, insurance agents, but we make up just a motley band of American and Oklahoma citizens. As she said, I was elected to the House in 2004. That's the first time term limits, which we proposed in 1992 on a statewide ballot initiative, actually took effect, and we had a wave of 39 new representatives come in 2004. Now, if you are math scholars, you know there's 101 people in the Oklahoma House of Representatives, so a good almost a half, a good third of the House was replaced that year. So with that, you serve at the pleasure of the Speaker. He is the one that puts you on committees, and I'm not sure why he put me in education. So I've served as the budget chairman of Common Education for the past 6 years. I was vice chairman the 2 years before that. So that's what brings me here today, is an interest in properly funding education. I will say that since 2008, we have done as good a job as can be expected in the recession of funding education. We've tried to, when we've cut other agencies up to 20%, we've tried to keep education, especially common education, as whole as possible. That being said, I know it hasn't been an easy road for our educators. They're trying to do a great job with less money. So this past year I did author a piece of legislation to fund education off the top, similarly to how we've funded transportation. It got some good legs. It didn't pass, but I think we got the attention of a lot of people. That is going to still be my mission this next year, is to find a stable funding source for education, because the one thing that we do need to do is give teacher pay raises. And a $1,000 teacher pay raise costs $50 million in the state of Oklahoma. So you can see the need to find a stable funding source to continue to give our teachers. And we are a very low-paid teacher state. We do not value our teachers enough monetarily as we should. So we're going to be looking at different avenues on how we can get a teacher pay raise and get the money to the classroom that will be sufficient to reward our teachers in the manner that they see fit so they can have a living wage. A few of our teachers are married, and they do fine, but there's a lot of, as Dr. Marshall said, As Dr. Marshall said, we have some ills in our state, and one of them is a lot of single families. And when a teacher is the head of a household of a single family trying to make a living wage for her or his family, it's a very, very, very tough job on the salaries we pay. One of the things we don't do very well is the length of our teacher salary. It's only 25 years. That needs to be extended, as well as the different steps. When we start out, we actually are not too bad. Compared to Texas and other states, we actually don't start out too bad. But the length of our teacher salary and the breadth of it, or how it grows each year, we definitely need to work on. So I'm willing to work on that. Anxious to talk about school funding. Very grateful for the Oklahoma Policy Institute to invite me today with the other panelists. Thank you.
Mr. Rob Miller is our next panelist. He has been a building level and administrator with Jinks Middle School for the past 12 years. He has served as site principal for the last 10. He has an MS degree in education leadership and a BS degree in geology. He has been in public education for 20 years, following 10 years as an artillery officer in the United States Marine Corps. As a teacher, he was twice selected as a site teacher of the year and was the Jinks Public School Teacher of the Year in 1999. In addition to his selection as the 2015 Oklahoma Middle School Principal of the Year, Rob was also selected as the 2014 recipient of the Advocate for Academic Freedom Award from the Oklahoma Education Association. Please welcome Mr. Rob Miller.
Thank you. And again, I'd like to echo just my appreciation for being invited to be part of this panel. And one of the reasons I like to be involved in these panels or seminars is I always learn new things. And it helps me articulate my own points of view when I have the opportunity to hear some of the other panelists, because we all have a different perspective. So mine is going to be a little different today. And I'm going to start off by showing you a picture. And I know you may not be able to see that all the way in the back, but this is a picture. I think its official name is the common grackle. It's a bird, common grackle. I call them Walmart birds. If you go to any Walmart, I think in the world, I know in Glenpool, I've seen ones in Texas where there are literally thousands of these things. I saw them in Florida over the summer, these grackles. And I wouldn't put it past Walmart that they haven't specifically bred, trained, and deployed these grackles throughout the country to help pick up small things and insects from their parking lots. Or possibly they're remotely piloted drones operated by somebody at NSA. So gives you a new perspective on that. But the reason I introduced the common grackle today is, if you ever watch one, it'll stress you out. Because they're constantly moving their head, tilting their head, looking every single direction. And we can understand that because, you know, you don't want to get hit by a car. Or you don't want to have a predator. I don't know what the predators of the common grackle might be, but they're very cautious. And I can't imagine living life like that. But then on the other hand, that's kind of where we've gotten to in public education today. Teachers and school leaders behave a lot like the common grackle, because we don't know what's going to fall out of the air next. Who's going to come after us? And so we've gotten in this defensive posture that's not productive, that's not good for kids, it's not good for schools. And my belief, what I submit to you today, is that much of the reform that's happened over the last 30 years, especially the last 15 with No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top, is predicated on the premise that American public schools are failing and that teachers and administrators are not sufficiently motivated to do anything about it. And when you start with that narrative, as Dr. Adams was talking about, then everything, every piece of data that gets thrown out there gets tied to this narrative. And in many cases, it's thrown there for political purpose, because someone has an agenda that they want to sell or a product they wish to sell. If we look at international test scores, in 2009, the Program for Student Assessment, a program for international student assessment called the PISA, ranked America right in the middle. I think we were 17th. And that prompted our president and Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, to throw up the alarms. This is our Sputnik moment. We've got to do something. And that, again, prompted Race to the Top. But when you really look at that data and disaggregate it, like Dr. Adams would do if he got a hold of these numbers, he would break them apart and say, what do these numbers really tell us? What we find is that if you disaggregate that data by ethnic group, by self-reported ethnicity, listen to some of these numbers. For students who self-report as Caucasian, American students are number two in the world, only behind Finland. We've all heard about what Finland does. For Hispanic students, students who report as Hispanic or Latino, American students are number one in the world, outperforming any Central American or South American country. Here's an important one. Asian students in the United States outperform Asian students in every Asian country, with the exception of Shanghai, China, which is a city that reports separately. So what does that tell you? If we break it down by socioeconomic status, schools in America that have less than 10% poverty, when compared to schools around the world with less than 10% poverty, are number one in the world. Schools with less than 25% poverty are number three in the world. So there's great things going on in public education. But we're stuck in this accountability paradigm that is stifling the kind of innovation we really need to have in public education. It holds us back because we're so focused on getting students to test scores and meeting a certain grade on A to F. And one of these days in America, we're going to come to the realization that a standardized test is a terrible way to measure the potential of a human being, because we're all different. And until we take that and we understand that kids learn differently and at different rates and we all have different passions and talents, and we need to exploit that, not try and put every child through the same pipeline, we're going to be stuck chasing test scores. And what we need to understand is that education today has to be different than it was when we went through school, when I went through school. Because we need to be teaching students how to be problem solvers and creative and innovative and teach those entrepreneurial skills, because we don't even know what jobs they're going to fill in 10 or 15 years. The world is changing that quickly. So we've got to change the focus from preparing kids to fill jobs to preparing kids to create jobs. That's what the focus needs to be. And again, test scores and accountability, while we all understand the need for it, is holding us back from the real kind of reform that we need to have in public education. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Mr. Kevin.
Mind if I just leave? These guys have got it all figured out.
You can say ditto, whatever you choose. Mr. Kevin Burr began as superintendent of Sapulpa Public Schools in 2012. Prior to that, he was associate superintendent of secondary schools for Tulsa Public Schools. In Tulsa, his leadership team was responsible for redesigning the district's alternative school network of schools. He was instrumental in leading Tulsa Public Schools' consolidation, called Project Schoolhouse, of 14 schools during the spring and summer of 2011. And he helped lead the district's implementation of value-added analysis and teacher and leader effectiveness, TLE, within the 35 secondary schools. The Tulsa model for TLE was later adopted by nearly 500 school districts in the state of Oklahoma. And on a personal note, something that's kind of fun. Are you ready? This was in his bio online, so I can say it. He and his wife are huge runners, and he ran the classic marathon in Athens, Greece last fall. Please welcome him.
I finished. That's all that matters, is I finished. Well, first of all, let me again echo everyone else and thank David for inviting me. I'm a last-minute fill-in, just so you all know. Everybody here was probably expecting Dr. David Goyne, who is much better than I am at articulating thoughts about education in Oklahoma. But he is celebrating the birth of a grandchild in North Central Texas, and I know all about that. I've got three grandchildren with one on the way. If you want to really get me to talk, ask me about Aniston, Chase, or Parker. And I'll spend the next hour and a half telling you everything you need to know about them. But I have the distinction of knowing each of the individuals on this panel personally, and I can't believe that I'm sitting here with them, because Kurt Adams is not only a great advocate for education, he's an instrumental part of shaping my thoughts about education, because he was one of my professors. And I can't think of someone who's more nationally important for articulating exactly what he talked about. Taking a look at the whole manner of inputs to what makes a successful school. And you need to read his stuff. He's good. And Anthony Marshall, I've known Dr. Marshall for close to 10 years now, and there's nobody that walks the talk better than Anthony Marshall does. He's a huge advocate, not only for his school, but for exactly what he talked about, for African-American students, and speaking up for the disparity in academic achievement between those two groups. Lee Denny, she walks the talk as well. There are a lot of people in the state legislature who want to advocate for education. There are very few that stand up and actually do it. And Lee Denny is one of those folks, and we're better for having her represent Oklahoma kids. And last but not least, every morning I read a view from the edge. If you haven't started reading Rob Miller's blog, I would encourage you to do so, because he is a master of metaphor and master of analogy, as you heard, and he's very, very good at what he does. Grackles, I'm going to use that. So I've got three things that I want to point out to you from a superintendent standpoint that are on the top of my mind. One, I'm going to pick up where Rob left off and say, as much as I want to completely do away with student achievement as an indicator of student success, I don't think that's a reality in our world. And where I want to start is with the assessment. The one thing that we've not spent a lot of time and conversation about in the state of Oklahoma is how bad our assessment is. We have an assessment system that not only does the things that Rob talked about, it does them poorly. And it's an assessment system that we shouldn't value in any way, shape, or form. And unfortunately, we've got an entire A through F system that's built on it. I'm a personal advocate of the state using something that can be nationally referenced, nationally normed referenced, like the ACT. For those of you that don't know, ACT and SAT are both involved in a lot of endeavors right now at the state level to produce a series of tests that give nationally referenced scores that can be comparable across state lines and can give those that are hell-bent on making comparisons about Oklahoma and where we rank, can be done so with some validity and with some enthusiasm from the public. So and in full disclosure, you all need to know that I actually sit on the National Advisory Board for ACT, but that gives me a unique perspective to understand exactly what the Aspire suite is setting out to do. Second, while we're talking about ACT, this is going to pick up where Rob left off. If you didn't know this, you need to know it leaving the room. The foundation for education isn't as bad as it's being characterized in Oklahoma. And this is picking up where Rob left off, as I said. Did you know that of the 7 indicators on ACT and SAT, of the 7, Oklahoma outperforms the national average on 6 of the 7? The only one we don't is math. We don't suck when you look at how we do nationally. There are only 16 states that test the same percentage or higher on ACT than Oklahoma does. We're one of the top 16 states in terms of the percentage of kids that we test. Did you know that of those 16 states, only 3 outperform us? You need to know that when you walk out the door, when somebody tells you that Oklahoma stinks when in educating kids. Okay, changing gears. We need to talk, 2 minutes. We need to talk a lot about teacher shortage in the state of Oklahoma. Here's a figure. I work in education. We try to fill approximately 30 vacancies every year in Sepulpa. We needed science teachers like you can't believe this year. We had 3 vacancies in science, and I'm sure Rob probably had the same kind of situation. Roughly 30,000 students are in the student body at Oklahoma State University, one of our major institutions that focuses on teacher education in fact, that's what its roots were, ag and teacher ed. 30,000 kids. You know how many graduates there were for science teaching at Oklahoma State this year? Give me a guess. 5 is close. It was actually 3.
Did you get them all?
We didn't get any of them. But it's changed our thinking. We're actually in Sepulpa, and I don't think that we're an anomaly. We're actually going to start interviewing and promising jobs to people who haven't yet graduated based on their successful completion. That's scary in terms of what it means to the entire system. But we have to place our emphasis where it is deserved, and we can't wait until we find out who actually graduates. Last but not least, and of critical concern to us in Oklahoma, and David Blatt is a tremendous voice for this, as well as Rob, I'm deeply concerned, as are my colleagues, on the continuing influence of national entities such as ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, the Walton Foundation, the Jeb Bush Foundation, and countless others who are shaping policy at the legislative level and at the State Department level for states not only like Oklahoma, but others across the nation. It's deeply concerning to me that those individuals are giving us direction for how to educate our children. Did I meet the 5 minutes, David? All right.
Thank you so much, Mr. Burr. We're going to keep this very informal because if you've had your television on or read a newspaper or looked at any news source in the past 12 months, I'm sure you have your own education questions, and I want to make sure that you have an opportunity to hear from these incredible experts. I'm going to throw one out, and then I'm going to toss it to you guys. And if you don't come up with more, I have a lot more on my list, okay? There are 1,000 different things to talk about, but high-stakes testing is probably something that all of you have an opinion on, and I know that some of you addressed it. Whether you want to talk about EOIs versus ACT or third-grade reading sufficiency or any of them, I want to throw the high-stakes testing your way to get your input, because I know it's affecting what teachers are doing in the classroom as well as the stress that our students are under.
Let me begin, first of all, with the EOI. I do not think, number one, that it is an adequate indicator of where the students are. First of all, let's look at the timing when it's administered, early March. Well, first of all, if you teach AP, which I teach, I haven't even gotten to Cold War and beyond. So what did I end up doing? I ended up cramming a quick memorization lesson into those students. They did not learn the subject matter. And that, fortunately, I guess somebody did a good job, because most of my students did very well, but it's not giving me an opportunity to actually teach. I taught them to memorize a few important facts so that they could pass that EOI. And in most of our classes, we're talking about tests that's given in March, the teachers haven't even had a chance to adequately instruct. So to put all of your eggs in one basket when they haven't even completed the school year, that's a major problem. And then again, particularly in schools that have administer a lot of AP and IB exams, we went straight from EOI to AP testing to IB testing. When did I have a chance to really teach instead of teaching them to memorize?
I'll just echo that. The EOI is basically, I said it a moment ago, the EOI is, it's a content test, and if the content changes, the test scores change. And we can't, and we use it to compare one year after another our students' performance. And there, and frankly, from a statistical point of view, and Kurt, you might want to join this conversation, from a statistical point of view, you really can't make any comparisons. They made this, he and his colleagues made this very clear in their A3F report.
Well, I have a quick question then, if I can ask a question. So now that the superintendent knows this, professors know it, the teachers know it, why is it that our legislators keep putting such an emphasis on passing this high-stakes test?
Okay. Well, now with the EOIs, high stakes, two of them are required by federal government. And as bad as our fiscal picture has been in Oklahoma, I actually do not think we want to turn and close the door on receiving federal money. We're already at risk of losing our waiver, which is going to be fine. That's not going to be a problem. But the Algebra 1 and the English 2 EOI are mandated by No Child Left Behind or the Elementary Secondary Education Act that we have to give that one. You know, we've had lots of talks on whether these should be high stakes or whether we should take away the high stakes and go with the ACT. They're all questions that we continue to wrestle with at the state level. But as you said, the EOIs, then the AP, and then the IB. Part of the problem is the stacking of tests. There's tests that the state requires, EOIs. There's tests that are AP that your district may require, and IB that's a district decision. So these are not all state legislature decisions. Some of them are local decisions, and that's one of the big problems, in my opinion. On we have not gotten together as a group and broad-based looked at what our testing is. And sometimes if you strip away the state tests, which we've looked at, there's still a lot of district tests and even school tests, so no one is taking a macro view at all the tests we're giving. And are we testing too much? Yes, definitely.
Can I give Dr. Adams an opportunity to respond?
Sure. I was just going to approach it from a more general level. You know, measurement theory, we talk about Campbell's Law, and essentially Campbell's Law states that anytime a social indicator becomes the basis of a consequential decision, then it's subjected to perversion and corruption. And there's nothing that probably illustrates Campbell's Law more than the inappropriate use of assessments. The high-stakes testing certainly would fall under that claim. So we have to assess students. The only way you can enhance your teaching and learning is by measuring performance and measuring knowledge. And so for me, the issue is, what do we do with those data? And as long as we continue to deprofessionalize education and put the data in the hand of policymakers who are so far removed from the actual learning experience, we're going to have a misuse of assessment data that then continues to perpetuate the types of corruption and perversion that we see happening within public education writ large, not just Oklahoma.
Mr. Miller, and then all of you are next. Don't worry.
I think they want to weigh in.
I do.
Yeah, this is scary.
Well, testing is obviously a passion for me, and it's something I've spoken out a lot. This past year, we had 1,670 students at Jinks Middle School. We administered over 6,400 individual OCCTs or EOI exams between April 10th and May 7th. So for an 18-day period, we had students testing every single morning and every single afternoon. As soon as we come back from spring break, teachers change gears, and in those 2 to 3 weeks prior to the opening of the testing window on April 10th, the focus becomes test prep. You have to remember, and a lot of people in the public don't understand, it's not a matter of taking all 1,600 of our kids and putting a paper test in front of them. Many of the tests now are online using a computer. I have 225 computers in my building set up for testing. Do the math, 6,400 tests, 200 computers. These tests have no time limit. You have 70 minutes or as long as you'd like. That presents logistical problems when you've got a regular school day where you've got a lunch, you've got other things in there that you've got to work around. So for 18 days, students are pulled out of their regular classes, it might be a math class or an elective class, because it's their day to test. So for 18 days, teachers are without a full class of students every period for 18 days. So they spend 2 to 3 weeks preparing kids for tests, 18 more days without a full class, kind of doing modified lesson plans because they know they're going to have to reteach something the next day because of 5 or 10 kids that are gone. Then we get done with testing, and we've got about 2.5 weeks before our own final exams in our core subjects. So where does the focus then turn? Well, now we've got to make sure we cover everything else and get kids ready for final exams that are for their grades. So in essence, the last 9 weeks of school is all about testing. And as a student, just imagine what that does to your love of learning, where this should be a time where we are bringing it all together, allowing students to interact with what we've taught them this year, doing project-based learning, doing creative team-based things, but instead we're putting them in front of a laptop for hours at a time and having them complete tests. It's the wrong model, and it's not going to close the achievement gap Dr. Marshall was talking about. All it's going to do is continue to widen that.
Okay, try to direct it to a particular panelist so that we can hear more questions and more answers since there's so many of you. How's that? Okay, let me start with you with the MacBook open. Oh, and identify yourself and where you're from as well.
Okay, now that was a multi-phase question. You know, I can give you the legislator's view on what the goal of education is, but remember we have to work with SDE, and we've had an adversarial relationship with SDE. Not only have...
I knew where you were going, and that's the best way you can put it.
And I'm going to mainly speak about the House of Representatives because the Senate had less of an adversarial role with SDE. State Department of Education. I think our schools superintendents, in my view, the state superintendent should be the superintendent's superintendent. And I think there's been an adversarial role there. I can't speak to that, but somebody else can. So I think basically our goal has been to prepare our kids to be, you're going to love this, college and workforce ready. That being said, in Oklahoma, we still have a 42% remediation rate when our high school kids go to college. And we can talk about why that is. There's multiple numbers from social factors all the way to education factors of why that exists. We started down the road to Achieving Classroom Excellence, which is ACE, which is the EOI program, back in 2005, 2006, with our goal to better prepare students to be college and career ready. And then we've spent this enormous time of putting in reforms that we think will better serve our kids. All the time while the federal government, as I said a minute ago, is handing down things like we have to have Algebra 1 and English 2 EOIs. Those have to be, they don't necessarily have to be high stakes, but they do have to be given. And so we've tried to, as I said a minute ago, 101 of us that are not, there's a few educators, but we're not all educators, trying to do what's best for Oklahoma. The last several years, we've spent time repealing a lot of those reforms. So it is chaotic, and it's mixed messages all across the board being sent down to our educators. I can see why we're in this predicament. Last year, I likened it to, I don't know if you've seen the movie with George Clooney in The Perfect Storm, the last see the last scene where that boat is in the middle of the ocean and it's just about to be sunk by that huge wave that's going to take it over. But I feel like that's somewhere where we are in education. We do lack some direction, or a lot of direction. We have a mishmash going on that we do need someone to sort out. And it's my fondest hope, is everybody in here going to vote that we pick the best candidate, and we know we're getting a new state superintendent for our public education, that we do get some direction, some working together, and some guidance on where we want to take education. I agree with you that PISA is maybe not what we should always look at and that we did do better, but there's got to be a reason, and it's not just teacher pay of why in so many numbers in education we rank in the 40s compared to the state. Now, I'm not saying we have to be number one, but I'd like to see us rise out of the 40s in the things we should be in the top 10 and rise out of the top 10 in the things where we should be the 40s. We're upside down in so many things in Oklahoma, and we need a plan and a clear direction on how to move forward.
If I can, I'd like to follow up. I appreciate the question because it kind of relates to what I started out saying. If we don't get the assessment part of this right, the whole conversation gets skewed. And with all due respect to Representative Denny, some of that conversation that you heard is slanted because of the assessment systems that we place value on. There's often the 42% figure that Representative Denny mentioned about college remediation rates in the state of Oklahoma. Don't forget, that's a skewed figure. There are two figures that aren't calculated in that 42%. Every kid that goes to a private school, that graduates from a Oklahoma high school, that goes to a private school, is not counted in that 42%. And all of the students who leave our state and go to college someplace else are not counted in that 42%. Those kids are being successful, and that's a significant number of kids every year in the state of Oklahoma. So our school system's not doing nearly as bad as it's being characterized. I want you to make sure that you take that away. I'm going to further clarify that for you. Of the 80%, don't forget, or excuse me, of the 42% that need remediation, our college going rate and acceptance rate in Oklahoma is the highest it's ever been in history, and it grows every year. I'm going to say that again. The college acceptance rate, despite 42%, is at its highest rate in history, and 80% of the 42% that Representative Denny mentioned, 80% are getting the remediation, guess where? Community colleges. Community colleges were part of a three-tiered system for continuing education, specifically designed to do exactly that, to bridge that gap. Our system isn't broken. Now, there are things that we need to fix. We're not at end game here. There are things that we need to address. But until we look at the factors the way that we really need to look at them, the conversation is going to get skewed. Do I sound opinionated?
Okay, you have an orange necklace on.
Want to address a particular panelist?
Yeah. I'll comment on that. I think it's an excellent question, and certainly it's one that often needs to be considered as you start to address the issue of assessment. For me, it comes down to the definition of high stakes. And to me, it's not the test, it's the test use. How are we actually using the data, and for what reason? And so, you know, clearly these assessments for higher education, continuing education, graduate school, professional education as well, too, have some high stakes attached to them in that they determine whether or not you're going to get admission into one of the schools that you desire. But the high stakes that typically are used in K-12 education are used for a different reason. It's usually used to blame somebody for past results or to make a value judgment on a particular indication. And my point of that is, I mean, just listening to our conversation up here about the use of data and statistics and indicators kind of supports that. What we have to be able to use assessment data is to get at an understanding of the why. So if we do have good admission rate into colleges, well, why? What is leading to that? What are some practices that are demonstrating some effectiveness of getting more students into college, particularly more socially disadvantaged and marginalized children into college. So for me, it comes back to the definition of high stakes. And high stakes is how you actually use the assessment data. We need to test. We need to give assessments. Assessments need to be good, but we need to use the information for the right reasons, which is to learn from it and to improve what we're doing, because we clearly have room for improvement.
For me, it's not doing away with what we call high-stakes testing, but again, look at what is being assessed, how the information is being assessed, and also, as I said earlier, scheduling the tests where they're better. Now, in terms of the colleges that continue to use them, then you're about to get me into a whole nother discussion about whether or not I feel as though those are truly proper indicators of a young person's ability to perform, because quite honestly, I know a lot of people that went into law school. Fortunately, they had some law schools that accepted them with lower LSAT scores, same with the MCATs, and they have gone on to become great in their profession. So when we start talking about what the colleges are using, that's a whole other argument, because, again, I personally do not feel that the MCAT, the LSAT, the ACT, the SAT, or even the EOI are adequate indicators of a student's ability to perform. I'm just saying. Whether or not people use it, that's a whole other discussion. But that's the way I feel, particularly with students of color.
I'd like to add just one thing, too, with all respect to Dr. Adams. We design the tests that we pick at the state for student success, not for student failure. Now, I'm not saying we have not been perfect at it. I get that. But our goal is student success and to make Oklahoma students the best they can be and to be successful at whatever they desire to do. That is our ultimate end game. It's a rocky road to get there.
I'm going to go ahead and take your question next.
My name is Brittany, and I live in Tahlequah. My question is this. As students with disabilities, helping students with disabilities be successful in college, what is being done? What do you think is being done about that?
Well, I'm the only higher ed representative here, so I guess I should try to address that. My knowledge is very limited in this regard. I would probably say, in general, this is a population of youth that is probably underserved and oftentimes left out of the conversation. I know a lot of the strategies we have in place in higher ed and also in K-12 are really insufficient for meeting their needs, and we've talked a lot about testing, and certainly testing would be one of those, and making sure we have assessments that actually represent what children are able to do. So I can't speak with a lot of authority, but just in general, this is a population that tends to get left out of the conversation and certainly needs to be brought in and not marginalized.
I think one of the more immoral and unethical things that we do is force all students, and I talked about this earlier, that we're not all the same, to force all of our students that have disabilities to undergo the same level of testing as all the rest of our students. This past year, they took away the modified option for student testing. So we have 8th graders, 7th and 8th graders in Jenkins Middle School and across the state that are forced to sit for the exact same test that a child who is gifted or talented is. What possibly could be the purpose for doing that? I can tell you the data from Jenks Middle School last year, and we've got, you know, high-achieving students. We also have 17% of our students are on IEPs, and with a very small exception that are portfolio kids, severe and profound, everyone else took the regular test. Our reading scores last year, 32% of students on IEPs passed the reading, 34% passed the math. We know we're going to get those results. Those students are in separate lab classes in smaller settings, being taught at the level that they are. And our teachers are working extremely hard, and those kids are working extremely hard. But in August, we're going to give them a piece of paper that says they're a failure. How does that possibly motivate anyone to work harder. And
I just want to clarify that they that took that test away is the federal government. You have to realize how important it is when you pick who you're voting for at the federal level, too. The they was the federal government, not the state government.
I'm going to, just real quick, I want to take a little bit of responsibility for this because I've got 35 years in education and speak from a position of experience. We didn't do over the last 35 years exactly what we should have done with students with different disabilities. And we have to take ownership of that. We spent a lot of time and effort segregating those individuals from high expectations, those individuals with disabilities with high expectations, regardless of their disability. Now, Rob's right. Specific to a particular disability, the test, either whether it's modified or whether or not you have assistance to navigate a regular test, that makes sense to all of us. But my apologies are for all of education as we look back at what we did wrong, and that segregation has enculturated where we are now, and we have to acknowledge that and move forward from it.
Yes. Safety.
You want to start, then I will.
From a personal perspective in Sepulpa, we've got a bond issue that's going to be, we're confident it's going to be passed August 26th, and it's $40 million, but it'll be about $34 million that we can actually spend. It's a lease revenue bond. And of the lease, we'll probably spend somewhere in the neighborhood of $3.5 to $4 million of that specific to student safety. I happened to sit on the governor's panel for student safety immediately following the tragic events in Sandy Hook. And we talked about a lot of issues, not just event-driven kinds of things where you might have a gunman or something that shows up on campus. But we talked about tornado shelters. And, of course, we all know in Oklahoma we've dealt with that situation more times than we ever needed to. But at the local level, we get a lot of input from our individual moms and dads and kids that tell us what they want and what they will and will not accept in terms of intrusions into their personal lives or the like. So we're dealing with that on a local level with local voters. I think that I'm not putting words in Representative Denny's mouth, but I think you'll probably hear the legislature continue to say that's a locally driven decision.
That's exactly why I let him go first, because it is a local by parents who elect their school boards and what the schools can do. You know, our school boards, they don't get enough recognition in what they're already doing. You know, the media picks up on things that are said at the legislature and puts a slant on it, but so many of our schools are looking at how can we protect against tornadoes? How can we protect against an intruder? And we can't forget, what if we had a building fire? There's so many, you know, one you keep them in, the others you get them out, and they're looking at this. They're being very forward thinking, and when they're building new schools and adding on to schools. And I have to say, if anything about where we disagree up here, our buildings and our building principals and our teachers always look number one at the safety of their students, and they have done yeoman's work, and they are the true heroes when we have events like this, whether it's laying on children during tornadoes or actually we've known in the United States of them taking a bullet for their kids. So it definitely needs to be a local decision, and that's what we do, is decisions like this are best made at the local level, and we totally support local school boards and local school districts in working what's best for their school district.
I do want to follow up real quick. One of the points that I didn't make that if you Google me, you'll find that I was very public about some comments. We have one of Representative Denny's colleagues that is from my hometown community of Sepulpa, and he introduced legislation immediately following the Sandy Hook events to encourage school districts and the state to allow teachers to carry guns in schools. I will tell you unequivocally, more guns in our schools is not a good idea.
Yeah.
and I will fight to the death to keep that from happening.
Okay, go ahead.
Let me say this as a teacher, and I applaud my administrators for always supporting me. Yes, there are standards, but as I mentioned at the very beginning, I teach the way I want to teach it. And that is allowed, and I think that is one of the reasons why I have been successful with my students in the classroom. I'm not afraid to step outside of the box. While there is a textbook that is designed to be used, I've already been through the textbook, but I don't go follow that textbook page by page. And I think Mr. Byrd probably would say that, and I hope, and maybe the middle school teacher would, as long as the teachers follow and make sure that standards are covered, there's no one saying you have to use this textbook and teach this chapter this way. Again, I'm excited about having administrators that understood the way that I teach. I push critical thinking. I demand it. And I can't just do that by following the textbook. That's why I have a supplemental text and other teaching mechanisms that I use. But I think, on the most part, truly passionate teachers are already doing that. Now, you have teachers in our school system that perhaps are not dedicated, hardworking, and student-driven, and they probably do just say, well, okay, here's the book, this is what I need to teach this week, and move on. But for the most part, I would think most of our teachers are dedicated, passionate, and they find ways to teach outside the box, to challenge their students, and do not feel pigeonholed by what the standards say. I may be wrong, but...
Could I maybe make a response? Actually, it's a great question because it brings up the classic tension in educational organizations, and that is one of top-down or bottom-up. And the reality is that the evidence doesn't support a top-down approach, and it doesn't support a bottom-up approach. It supports a middle ground, kind of a both-and. We have to have structure within our organizations, within our school systems. We have to have ways to regulate. We have to have ways to guide and to shape behavior. And so, you know, the classic example, there are teachers who probably show up and teach straight from the textbook and they don't inspire kids, and their performance is not what we would call satisfactory. And we have to have protocols in place to be able to remove ineffective teachers from the classroom. So, I mean, this is a classic tension that I don't think we've been able to really fully answer. Oftentimes, what happens is we create an imbalance. And so when we react to a particular indicator that is poor, then we tend to constrain the system by putting more rigorous controls that try to routinize what we do. And that's not going to get us to where we need to be. School systems are very complex organizations. They're defined by non-standard tasks and outcomes, and we need processes that allow for the adaptability. And right now we don't have that, so we need to really create structures that allow for more professional autonomy. And autonomy is not do whatever you want to do. Autonomy is having the ability to think through what the needs of my students are and how I can appropriately engage them with the structure, the curriculum, the assessments that maybe are tools for me to be able to use. So a classic tension. We could look at some other nations to see how they're doing. Obviously, Finland is quite recognized for its work and what they're doing. They're having success. Singapore has not followed the typical Asian model of strong control over there as well, too. So there are examples we could look at for how to make it work.
And I know Dr. Adams is being humble here because he truly is an expert on this idea of self-determination theory and the idea of autonomy within organizations and that social structure and the importance. And at my school and in every school, it really starts with the leadership in developing a culture of, I like to call, defined autonomy, where we have limits. You know, there are some non-negotiables. This is the way we do things in this building, and you're going to stay within those rails. But at the same time, within that, you have the absolute autonomy in terms of choosing the technique or the time or the process that you're going to use to bring that along. And one of the simple rules, I'll just close with this, that I tell every single teacher is the expectation in my building is 175 quality lesson plans every year. What you define as quality can be a little nuanced, but I don't expect teachers to do 170 and then have five movie days or five take-a-break days. There is that expectation that you bring your A game every day of the year, and that is part of the culture. And teachers know that, because when I walk into a room and I say, was that one of your 175? Because it didn't seem to meet what the criteria is, they get the message. At the same time, we don't micromanage what they do. We give them trust and autonomy and build that culture.
Outstanding question, and it's probably a root question for all of our conversations up here. And Dr. Adams, you stated it perfectly. It's someplace in the middle, and that defined autonomy, I like that too. But I come at this maybe uniquely on this panel. I was in education. I was teaching English when A Nation at Risk came out. And all of this conversation goes back to 1983 when that was produced. And what caused it to be produced was a terrifically inadequate articulation of an established, expected, I'm going to use the word standard, that could be expected of every student across a wide spectrum, not only the state of Indiana, but across the entire Midwest and the United States. Now, I know that starts to talk about nationally based standards, but it was a standard approach. What students got in terms of a grade, and let's say an A in algebra in Oakland, California, should be somewhat similar to an A in algebra in Oklahoma City. And at the time, that wasn't the case. And unfortunately, you were at the luck of the draw, whether or not you got an Anthony Marshall to teach you or somebody much less adequate than Anthony. And what he chooses to teach, if left to his own autonomy, is not necessarily something that the public is comfortable with in a public education. Now, whether or not teachers are comfortable with that is a wholly different conversation. But the public's not willing to let educators make those kinds of decisions on their own. They like to say they are until their kid gets screwed. Now, I'm sorry that that's as roughly stated as it is, but that's when it starts to rear its head, when a mom or dad thinks that their kid got something less than their friend's kid got. And that's where we start this conversation about standards. It's a difficult organizational conversation to have.
Okay, not you in the first row. We'll come back to you next. In the third row. Yes, sir.
Is that what he's been dying to ask over there?
The honest answer to that is there is very limited data on that, because many countries don't report that separately and don't test that separately. So if we make comparisons with African-American students in our country, we're really comparing to sub-Saharan Africa, and many of those countries don't even participate in the international test. So there aren't valid comparisons, but if you were to compare what the data is, African-American students in America outperform students of color in every other country. I don't share that statistic because it's not really based on good background. There's not good comparisons there, so it's not real valid. And I want to just add one more thing just about the PISA that's very important, and it ties in kind of the underlying lesson of today for policymakers, is always peel back the numbers. Look underneath those numbers. The PISA test that I quoted and gave you statistics, the year that that test was given in 2009, there were 6,200 American students who took that. That's out of the entire freshman class in the United States of America. Less than 0.1% of Americans participated in that test. So it gets into what's an adequate sample in order to make judgments, and we're making very important judgments about the state of public education based on the performance of 0.1% of our kids.
Well, I raised a real fast on that one. Number one, I actually under the insistence of five young men, started a movement at Booker T called Men of Power. And I'm glad to say that I see Demario Solomon Simmons. He's helped me a lot with that. Kevin Matthews' son, Representative Matthews' son, was actually one of the founders of Men of Power. He's here. And then Mr. Darryl Mercer, who I believe is participating with you guys, he has been up at Booker T helping me. Now, what that does is we try very hard to catch these young men when they first get to Booker T in the ninth grade. And as a matter of fact, we now have programs at Carver Middle School as well as Hawthorne, where we're trying to instill in these young men the need for academic excellence, first of all, to avoid this pipeline that you referred to. And I think it's very important that we understand, particularly for students of color, African Americans, that young men especially need to see positive role models. I make sure that they see that in me each and every day when I come into that classroom, not just because of what I'm teaching, but in my walk, in my talk. Trust me, the way you see me dressed right now, they won't see this on the first day of school. Because, yes, I will have on my suit, my tie. I want to always be a positive role model. And then the other thing that I try to do to avoid this prison pipeline is help these young men understand that it's okay to do well in school. Teachers and administrators deal with a lot of social issues aside from the, other than academics, that we have to confront again. When we talk about reforming our educational system, it's going to take more than just academics. It's going to take changing the entire culture of our school system to understand that when that young man comes in, he may have an attitude. That doesn't mean you necessarily have to send him to the dean of students because he did not say yes, ma'am, or yes, sir. You need to reach out to that young man or that young lady and meet them where they are. We're going to have to change the culture. We're going to have to also work with our community and the parents if we're going to effectively change it. But I'll talk more maybe afterwards and share with Men of Power, or you can get with Mr. Mercer and get more information about Men of Power. But I think it's a very effective program. As a matter of fact, Kevin's son is publishing another book. And again, he was one of the founders of this particular program, and it has been quite effective. And I have all sorts of data that I won't take up any more time that I'd love to share with you on Men of Power afterwards.
I'd like to make a response. I think that's a great question. This kind of follows up with Dr. Marshall was saying. But I want to put it in a context. And it's a context of if we look at all of the research that's been done on school effectiveness and teacher effectiveness, and we take all these various studies, and we actually do what we call we decompose the variance in achievement. So we separate out the reasons why we see differences in students' achievement scores. On average, about 7 to 10% of that variance is attributed to teachers. About 20% is attributed to schools, anywhere from 20 to 25%. So by far, the majority of variance in achievement test scores, and this isn't just my research, this is national research, is attributed to what we call error. These are unknown factors. So if we're going to start to address achievement gaps and an inequitable achievement distribution that we find in far too many of our schools, the only way we're going to be successful is if we take this collaborative approach to education. And we involve nonprofit organizations. We involve the community. We involve the parents. If you look at a lot of the national models that are out there that are having success, Harlem Children's Zone gets a lot of recognition for its work. It's taking a collaborative community approach to these issues and challenges. And until we have policies that support working within communities to enhance not only the quality of education but the quality of life for our children, we're not going to be successful. And we know this. Julius Wilson, one of the great sociologists of the University of Chicago, wrote the book on concentrated poverty back in the 1980s. And the number one finding from that book is that there's a lack of social structure in high poverty communities that hinders access to the type of social networks that these children, these families need to gain access to opportunities. And so they started to call this thing called social capital. Social capital is having the resources embedded in our relationships. What Dr. Marshall was talking about is creating the social resources that children need. And too often children of poverty are blocked from having access to those resources. So we have to take kind of a collaborative community-based approach to this, in my opinion.
We only have 11 minutes left, and so if your hand is up right now, we're going to try to get to you, but that means with 10 minutes. That means with each question, we're going to have one response so we can get through them. So you're going to be first. You're going to be second. You guys remember your numbers because I'm not going to, okay? Tyler, you're going to be third. In the back, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth. This is going to be really fast, so state it fast, answer it fast.
Okay. Hey, my name is Marcus Butler, Oklahoma City. My question.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. And, you know, we look at that, and it's just hard to turn the Titanic on a dime. And it's been a money crunch problem. I know you guys are sick of hearing that, but where do you put the money? And we believe that we should be putting it more into education. And we have funded education at a higher level than we're funding DOC. But this is what we're worried about, that pretty soon, if we don't do something to address exactly what you're talking about, then we're going to be, those numbers are going to flip, and we're going to have to pay more to incarcerate people. We incarcerate more women than any state, and we're third in any country in the world in incarcerating women. That's heinous. That's tearing up families at the lower level. We have the last 3 years started looking at justice reinvestment with Speaker Chris Steele and getting more people out of prison. And that's very tough. And I know this isn't what you want to hear, but it's very tough with the high Republican majority because we're the party that's tough on crime. So we're trying to put in programs that will get people out of prison and make sure that when they come out of prison, they at least have a GED where they will be employable. But we're looking at that. Representative Lisa Billy from the Purcell area has picked up the mantle of Chris Steele on the justice reinvestment. And I think you'll see some legislation that's going to start to turn the Titanic away from incarceration and back to education. That's all I have to offer.
Number two.
I don't have all those studies. I can tell you at my school, the achievement gap is too large. There's no doubt about it. And we are very concerned about the performance of all students, but particularly the gap between students of poverty, students of color, our Hispanic students, English language learners, students with disabilities, all of those groups. So to place the focus on any one of those, we don't try and do. We try and look at individual children, regardless of their condition. But I understand your question is, how do we address this? And the answer is I don't have enough time. And, you know, I know Dr. Adams could talk for hours about this particular thing. This is truly the issue, though. But we're spending so much time chasing test scores and chasing some of these other reforms that we're not putting the kind of capital into it, looking at the social structures and what we can do in our communities to really help those who need the help.
Just a quick response. It persists. With my data in Tulsa County, it persists. It's typically large. The African-American achievement gap to Caucasians is typically larger than the Hispanic gap to Caucasians, and it's typically larger than the free or reduced lunch gap. Our current accountability system is incapable of actually measuring the achievement gaps that exist within schools. As a state, I think what people have talked about earlier as a state is we're directionless. I see really no clear target and clear focus for what we're doing as a state. I see a lot of ideas. I see a lot of people who really want to address this problem, are working hard to try to make it better. But we really don't have what I would call a clear theory of action that it's based on quality evidence, strong theory, to support how it's going to work. And until we get some direction of the state where people actually stop talking past each other and start working together, then you know we're not going to be successful unless that happens. For example, I mean, what I hear all the time is, I mean, we look to the federal government and we blame the federal government, or we look to the state government and we blame the state government. But the reality is, we can all do more and we can all do better, starting with higher education. I need to be a better instructor. I need to prepare administrators and policymakers better. And I think if we take that approach that we have to work together and we all can get better at what we do, then maybe we'll have some success.
Number four.
Well, in terms of expectations and action, I think that Representative Denny mentioned it a moment ago, you start with the most influential people within that community, and it's likely going to be your school boards that are going to influence local decisions that are going to affect kids within a smaller community. I heard it addressed earlier, and I've been a part of it, and I know Kurt's done a lot of research on it. The community school initiative within Tulsa and Union Public Schools, and then and now is expanding to Oklahoma City and some others, takes that notion that you talked about and puts it into action and starts to connect some of the social constructs that can't be addressed through policy. They have to be addressed through people and individuals, and actually puts it in place. So, you know, there's not a great answer. That's the best one that I can give you. Well, at the most micro level, you're talking about within the school and within the small communities that surround that school. A great example is right across the street over here at Kendall Whittier, where you get to the most micro level of something that's been in existence now for, what, Kurt, 12, 13 years? And it's and the culture, the enculturization, is that a word? Of what's going on there has become something that is expected.
I've got to add, the most micro level is parents, and that's in the culture of the family, and that's something we can't legislate, and that's something that we have to get back to. And we've had a breakdown of the American family, not just in Oklahoma, all across the United States, and that is an innate problem that I think Dr. Adams mentioned the Harlem Children's Zone. That's Jeffrey Canada has gone to that as the root of what he's built there. And if you want to affect policy from a health perspective and a school perspective and a rural community perspective, we've got to somehow learn how to build up and edify the family, the very basic nuclear family, and start with that.
Number five and six and seven, you are going to have to come down and talk to these panels after it works. But number five, you get the last question.
The definitive author.
Gosh.
In 30 seconds, Kurt.
I have learned that it's really hard to try to simplify what the letter grade means. As you know, the letter is actually a simple indicator, but the problem is that it's not representative of school performance. And so how do you get that to communicate? For me, when I was speaking in Edmond, perhaps the best illustration of the validity problems associated with the grade. Now, mind you, validity is not a property of the measurement itself. It's a property of measurement use, right? So we get this grade, and a school gets an A, and we say this is an outstanding school. It's an effective school. Well, that's an inaccurate use of that information because we don't really know what the grade actually tells us. And so perhaps the best example I gave was I showed in Edmond schools and a Putnam City school, I broke down their performance by the different components. And there was, within the same district, I can't remember which Edmond district it was, but two similar schools. One was the intermediate school, one was maybe the elementary school. And the overall grade for one of the schools was a C, and for the other it was a B. The school that got the C actually had a higher grade on each of the indicators. They just didn't get the bonus points. But they got the overall grade a C, and that's what people ultimately judge. And so we actually have done an analysis based on the changes to the legislation. And as you might expect, the problems actually persist and are much worse when you hold constant factors that schools have no control over. So how do you communicate to the public? I think simple examples, looking at report cards from schools and seeing how there's just an inconsistency in overall grades, even though you might find the actual same scores on each of the components, for me, told it best.
You guys are an excellent group of questioners. You did a wonderful job. And thank you to our panelists who have years of knowledge and more to share. I went last night to CVS to get them all Smarties because I knew how smart they were, and luckily CVS didn't have them, so I got them Lifesavers because that's really what they're doing is saving lives. So thank you all for being here today.